Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall and you're listening to the Downtime Podcast supported by Komoot. This week I'm going to be chatting with Scotty Loughland. As you'll hear, this guy goes on some amazing adventures and he uses Komoot to help him with route finding and navigation. Komoot is a route planning and navigation app with some awesome features and they also have a free gift for you all. Komoot is great for planning routes on or off-road, either on your phone or on a computer. Just give it a start and an endpoint and Komoot will plan the best route for you. It will break down the route by surface type, and when the trail's off-road, it will tell you the technical difficulty of the trails based on the single track scale. It's compatible with devices like Wahoo and Garmin, making it super easy to get your route onto those if you prefer to use them rather than your phone. Komoot will then give you turn-by-turn navigation so as you can focus on enjoying the ride rather than working out where you're going. Komoot is free to download and use, but they're kindly offering Downtime listeners a free regional map bundle of your choice worth $8.99, which means you can then take those maps offline and you don't need a phone signal. All you need to do is to head to komoot.com/G. That's Komoot, spelled KOMOOT.com/G, and use the code Downtime2020, all one word, all uppercase. That offer is valid for all new Komoot users until the end of April 2020, so head over to komoot.com and give it a try for free. If you're enjoying the podcast and you want to help it keep going into 2020 and beyond, then there's a few things you can do. Tell your friends about the podcast and get as many people listening as you can. You can share the episodes on your social media, or you can head to downtimepodcast.com/shop and either grab yourself some of our merchandise or click on Share the Love to make a financial contribution of your choosing to help keep the podcast getting better and better. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you get every episode delivered to your device as soon as it drops. Just head to downtimepodcast.com/subscribe and you'll find all the links that you need. This week, I'm joined by Scotty Loughland. We chat about his journey from World Cup downhill racer through the Enduro World Series, his stint as a presenter at GMBN, and into his current role as someone who creates his own video content and stories for a number of brands. As a result of that, he gets to travel the world riding his bike with some of the top riders on the planet. So, without further ado, here's Scotty Loughland. Scotty Loughland, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. How's it going?
Good, thank you. Excited to be here, have a chat about mountain bikes and all things riding.
Awesome, good stuff. Well, let's start off and just get a bit of a background on who you are and how you got kind of to where you are now. So first off, just tell us a little bit about how you got into riding, because I think, was it motor trials that was your first love when you were younger?
Yeah, so I started on motorbikes when I was probably, I think, 4 years old. And my earliest memory is my dad putting me on the bike, talking over how you like ride the bike, obviously. This is a throttle, this is a brake, blah, blah, blah. And probably as a youngster, not really paying attention and just going straight across the back garden, dropping off like what was probably a 2-inch little curb into the dirt. And then the throttle just going full open as my arm drops as I fall down off the curb and just straight into the garden fence. And that put me off for probably about a year, I think, of riding any bike of any sort. And then picked it back up, got on a TY80 and started loving riding trials, moved up onto a 125. And just really from there on, it was just all about bikes. Went to the 2002 World Cup in Fort William. Had already been inspired by Carrick Crawford Anderson and Stu Thompson from their trials background, saw that they were racing at this event, went to watch them, cheer them on as sort of local heroes, watched events, saw PT there, and then was just hooked on mountain biking. And I remember going up the local woods, building trails, riding the trails that Stu Thompson had been riding, and just having an absolute blast on a mountain bike. And it just all kind of developed from there.
Amazing. Can you remember what your first mountain bike was?
The first one as a youngster was like it was all yellow. I can't even remember the brand. I then had a giant boulder, and my first proper bike was a Diamondback Jump Comp with Judy forks, a disc brake up front that was mechanical, and a V brake on the rear.
Nice. Yeah, things have moved on a bit, haven't they, when you look back to those older bikes?
Well, I remember actually the first race I did was at Dunkeld, riding that Dunkeld downhill track. As a juvenile, you start at the halfway point and it still had a gnarly rock garden. Yeah. I don't think, going back now, if you gave me a hardtail with 100 mil travel, probably super steep, that I'd probably go and be able to ride it the way that I did as a juvenile. So it's pretty funny how you develop with the bikes as well.
Yeah, that is a gnarly trail as well, having ridden it on a modern 150 mil bike. Like, that's a handful on a hardtail.
So yeah, it was pretty scary. And I remember competing against the likes of, I actually think Danny Hart was there, and it must have been the time that he was on, I think, MBUK in Scott. And that was pretty cool seeing him there. And then from that event onwards, it just kind of accelerated into racing more and more. I only did one race that year. I think it must have been 2013. Then the next year I did more SDAs, and the next year built up to doing some more what were at the time NPSs. And then it just kind of developed from there, more BDSs, more traveling the country. And I remember going to Morzine for the first time in Leger, and I was actually with Danny Hart then. And we did about a week's riding and had an absolute blast. Went to Max's Cup in Mount Geneva, I think it was. And we had a really good time. The track was like nothing that I'd ever seen before. Big, steep alpine terrain. And that's when the racing really kicked off for me. And I think I was about 16 then.
And the bug got hold of you. You were kind of living and breathing it from that point onwards.
Oh, I didn't want to do anything but ride my bike. I just absolutely live for it.
Were you pretty competitive from the start then? Were you getting quite good results, or was it something you had to work at?
It was a bit of a slow burn, I'd say. I remember building from, it was really, starting out, it was really just about having fun. And then as I got a little bit better, you'd see like you'd get into the top 15 in youth. And at the time, it was actually really competitive in Scotland. There was a lot of youth riders who were all about the same time. You had like Sam Dill, Josh Briceland, Danny coming up every weekend to race them. And that kind of just pushed you forward as a rider, because you were having to get quicker and quicker. And if you wanted to stay in that mark, and I think there's about 10 youth riders, like Joe Flanagan, Sam Flanagan were also there. We're all about the same level, all pushing each other every weekend, having an absolute time at it as well, practicing with each other, 7-8 run practice runs, and then going on to race. And, you know, you'd get two runs at the SDA. So the first run, you could see where you were, and then the second run, you could kind of lift up where you were and see if you could go a little bit faster, change this line, do that, and see if you could move up the ranks. So it was really, really fond memories. And actually talking about it now, all the memories are just flooding back.
Awesome. Yeah, it was a good crew. There's a lot of fast riders pushing each other, and a lot of those riders kind of progressed onto the World Cup stage. Do you remember your first World Cup downhill? Where was it?
First World Cup downhill, I think it was Maribor, Slovenia. I was on a trade team with Ali Parkin, Ben Einison. I was riding a Santa Cruz V10. And I think it was at that point where you didn't really need many UCI points to get in, or you could be on a trade team. And there was about 350 people entered it. And I remember finishing around 180th, I'd say, and being pretty blown away by the speed, the intensity, the sizes of the tracks, but having an absolutely amazing time doing it. And that was sort of the main takeaway from it, was having a good time. And then working out how you could progress as an athlete, how you could go faster, the things you needed to change. Was it the bike? Was it physical? And then really going from there. That was basically as a complete privateer, where it was self-funded to go there. I'd actually bought the bike as well at trade price from Cole Williams, who had Fly Distribution at that time. And it was a fun experience. And there was 10 of us on the trade team, and we all kind of pushed each other and became like our own little team, helping each other in practice and riding. And yeah, great memories.
Yeah. What kind of stuff was it that you felt you needed to personally work on to work your way up the ranking?
I think the biggest thing was not really having traveled at that point. I hadn't seen a track like that before. The Scottish tracks are very different to anything, well, apart from Fort William, of course. But like all the other Scottish tracks are slower, they're in the trees, whereas going to Maribor, it was flat out, it was open. There was big gaps that I hadn't really seen before. There was jumps, and it was just a much higher intensity race level. So it was just almost changing everything up. I had to get more physically fit as well. It just wasn't fit enough or strong enough to hold on to 4 minutes at that level. And then I think the next round was maybe in Fort William. And going there, obviously, I'd raced it for probably 4 years, and I sort of moved right up the ranks from being 188th or something like that, the first one, to maybe about 110th. And that was a big jump, just having another couple of months being used to that intensity of like riding and racing and actually getting a little bit fitter and being back in the bike.
Yeah. And were you studying at the same time as a lot of your World Cup career?
Yeah. So the first year that I did it, I think that I just finished school, and I basically went from having done like sixth year exams to then going racing. And then for the rest of my career, I studied as a mechanical engineer and was also racing. So you'd spend sort of September until May studying, and then you'd have May until September racing. So actually, like, it worked really well, but you also didn't get to travel and train the same way as a lot of the full-time athletes were. So that was a slight disadvantage, but I definitely don't hold a grudge, because I think going to university and actually getting the degree was one of the best things that I could have done for myself. Even though I don't fully use a degree now, actually learning in a group environment and studying with people is such a good thing to do.
Yeah, it rounds you out a bit, I guess, rather than just being focused on the riding and the racing.
Totally. And I went from being at school where I went to a rugby focused school and mountain biking wasn't that accepted. Went to university and it totally flipped around. I had a sports scholarship, so I had access to someone who could offer training. I had a physiotherapist and a small amount of money to help me get to a race or two per year, which was a massive benefit, because at the time didn't have any financial support. I was actually still buying bikes as well. I'd get them trade or get free parts here and there, but no sort of factory deal or extra support. It was all on your own. And when you went to a World Cup, you were lift sharing with people in rental cars and you had very limited spares. So when you see that now to actually having been a factory team, you realize how big a benefit it has.
Yeah, massive difference. What was it that made you move on from World Cup racing to give the Enduro World Series a go?
I think just living in Scotland. We are very lucky where we have the right to roam law. You can basically go anywhere on a bike. As long as you're respecting of the land and the people who are working, or if there's horses or walkers, you give way to them. And a lot of the time when I wasn't racing, I'd go for a big, long sort of 3-4 hour, what were just called, I guess, really cross country or all mountain rides. And we'd end up riding to the top of a lot of the downhill tracks, riding down them on 4 or 5 inch travel bikes and having an absolute blast. And then when the enduro thing actually started to develop, I was like, this looks really, really cool. And the first year of the Enduro World Series, a lot of the tracks that we rode were just extended long downhill tracks. They weren't overly physical. There weren't many like big sprints in the middle. There was pedals between stages and things, but the descents were definitely more downhill orientated and focused to someone who had downhill skills. So that really, really appealed to me. And just went for that. It's like a new, fresh thing. I just finished university at that point and saw it as a bit of an opportunity, I guess, to get into that and maybe see if I could get onto a team or get extra support that way.
So were you still focused then on kind of becoming a pro rider at that point?
Yeah, I think one of the way that I was raised was my parents always wanted me to get the degree. And I went through university, I actually did 4 years mechanical engineering, got my bachelor's. And halfway through that fourth year, I had the opportunity with my grades to go into the master's course. And I figured, well, why not? I'm here. I feel that I have the credits to do it. And I'd probably never go back and do the master's. So I might as well just do it now. So I decided to do an extra year studying. And then with the goal at the end of that year to become pro. So did a season again as a complete privateer, went up to Europe in my van with a friend from university, Fraser, who's actually moved on and he works in the bike industry now. He was at We Are One Composites as the lead engineer, which is pretty cool connection there. We went out for, I think, about 4 weeks. We traveled around. We started in Lake Garda, went to the first EWS in Punta Ala and did okay. Was a bit rusty after not having ridden for basically 2 months or trained. And then sort of throughout that season, my results sort of progressed. And by the end of it, I did the European Cup in Ischgl in Austria and got sixth, with the likes of like Jerome Clements winning. I think Mark Weir was there. There's a couple of big names who I was right in the mix with. And at the end of that, Cube approached me and were like, really interested. We can see that your results are improving. And that's where it really sort of kickstarted, and that's the end of 2013 going into 2014. I joined Cube.
And was that like a pro deal effectively at that point? Were you getting a salary?
It wasn't a salary. It was, the support was with bikes. So you got, I think I got 3 bikes that year, and then they paid for all travel expenses. And the main thing was if you got good race results or magazine publicity, okay, you got bonuses. Yeah. So it wasn't, definitely wasn't a professional deal, I guess, but it was a step in the right direction of going somewhere. And that was a two-year deal.
Yeah. And what was it like riding for a team and having that support after all those years kind of going the privateer route?
I think the first thing that really stuck out for me was getting the bikes. The bikes were immaculately, perfectly built. I didn't have to do any of that at all. And we went to team camp in Finale. And it was also time to be there with Fox Suspension. So I met Jordy for the first time. Fitzy was there as well. And we spent a full day just back-to-back runs testing suspension. And coming off the mechanical engineering side, I absolutely loved going down the run, thinking about what was working, where the suspension, what the suspension was doing, where it was feeling good, and the changes that could be made to actually improve it, and then giving that feedback to the guys and listening and seeing what they changed and how all that came together to make the bike feel better and ride faster down the trail. And it was just a really interesting and insightful day for me.
Yeah. How much time did you, do you remember how much time you managed to find on that track through a couple of days of suspension setup work? Was it significant?
It was, so we didn't really do much timing. I think it was about 10 seconds overall on about, I think it was about 5.5 minute track from memory.
Okay.
But yeah, a lot of it was based on feel, and we're sort of setting up with the thought of, you know, could you ride this further? Is it arm pump that you're dealing with? Is the bike not gripping into the ground? Where are you losing traction? Where can traction be gained? Are you going through the suspension too fast? Does it need to be firmer? Does it need to be more progressive? What's the damping doing? And it was just sort of a, it was really getting the bike balanced so you had a perfect base setting so that then you could go to the next event and go from there with setup if you needed to change something depending on the length of the tracks, because enduro is so variable, right? You had, there was that year rounds in Scotland, but there was rounds in Chile and then in the Alps. So sometimes you might only have a 3-minute stage, but you'd also the next event have like a 15, 20 minute stage.
Yeah. So do you think it gave you that kind of context in which to help you set up your own bike for those other races then? It helped you understand what everything does.
Yeah, just helped you understand what the bike was doing and also what you could do to change it, to make it feel better, to make you feel more comfortable. And ultimately, if you're feeling comfortable and confident, you're going to be a faster rider and racer.
Yeah. And was it like, was there one particular setting that you find helps you get the bike set up that you vary quite a lot from place to place? Or is it really like you have to understand all the different variables and how they interact?
It's a good mix of both, I'd say, but the one thing that I think I probably changed and played the most with was rebound and also the progressivity of the bike. I probably had the forks up too progressive, and we took a little bit out and played with the air volume there and then also the air pressure so we could get that really dialed in, and that would help with arm pump, which was the biggest thing when you're riding a 15, 20 minute stage.
Okay, so making the fork a little less progressive and a little less stiff.
Yeah, and I think that's even what a lot of the riders are still doing now when I read up on things and watch a couple of the EWS videos, is that they have it a little softer so they can basically keep going. Because I was kind of, you know, I came from a downhill background, and you looked at the likes of Aaron Gwynn at that time, and they're running a super stiff front fork and kind of had followed that, I guess, that trend.
Yeah, I guess with EWS, it's more about kind of minimizing fatigue over the length of the event rather than ultimate like max speed through a section, whereas downhill, you want it to be kind of stiff and fast, I suppose.
Yeah, you've got to be consistent right throughout the day, because if you've got 5 stages compared to 1 race run that the downhill guys are doing, that's a very different way that you've got to ride and race and prepare for.
Yeah, yeah. So how did you then get from kind of that career progression and the EWS side of things and getting onto a pro team to moving on to being a GMBN presenter, because that's quite a shift.
Yeah, a massive shift. I guess the racing side never really worked out in the way that I perhaps had thought it was going to. I got up to a point where I was like in the 30s to 40s, but that wasn't really good enough to get on a proper professional deal and get a salary. And I'd always enjoyed the media side of things, filming. I'd never done any presenting though. And GMBN's thing at that time was that they wanted professional races. They had Martin, they had Mark Beaumont, and they had Donny at that time. And they wanted to keep that going. So Neil got in touch and asked if I wanted to do like a trial. And I was definitely up for a new challenge. The Cube deal had kind of, it was going to be renewed, but in a way that I wasn't super stoked on, I guess, okay, and wasn't going to offer like something that I could do full time. So when the GMBN opportunity came up, I kind of took it on. And yeah, it was just a new challenge. And I like learning, I like doing different things. And went out to Malaga with those guys for about 10 days, learned a lot from day one to day 10. The like variation in confidence in front of the camera was massive. And at the end of it, came back and they offered a job that was full time based down in Bath. So I did that for the next, it was about 18 months, and had a good time. It was a new challenge. Feel like I progressed to a point that I didn't really know what I wanted to do next. And it was based in Bath. And whilst there's a really good scene riding in South Wales, it never really captured what I loved about mountain biking, which was up in Scotland. And I had a good riding crew up here, and I love being in the wild. I don't like being near sort of cities or anything like that. I like it being like really clean and sort of no one around. So I guess that was kind of my attraction, was I wanted to come back to Scotland, and the GMBN job didn't offer that. So it was kind of the next thing was to decide what I wanted to do next. And I wanted to go my own way and sort of take what I'd learned a little bit from GMBN, do my own thing, travel more to places that I'd maybe never been before and ride my bike. And it kind of grew from there.
So how did you approach making that happen then? Because it's pretty hard to move from a sort of solid salaried position to going it your own way and building your own business effectively.
Well, the first thing that really got it going was that GoPro actually approached me, and they asked me to join the GoPro family, which is a group of worldwide creators, not just in mountain biking, but collectively across like vlogging. They have like Nick Pischetto. There's a whole pile of people who do different things like skydiving, skiing, snowboarding, winter sports, surf, whatever. And that was like a really cool opportunity. So I went out to Leogang to watch the World Cup with those guys. And I met four other content creators who had an interest in mountain biking, but weren't necessarily mountain biking. And I saw what they were doing and how they were capturing it and telling stories. And I was like, this is really cool, but no one's really doing this for mountain biking right now. And I figured it could be something that I really wanted to develop in the future. And that relationship with GoPro carried on. I went to a couple of other events with them that year. They gave a little bit of support for trips I wanted to do and help film for them. And yeah, it just developed. I'd never actually picked up a camera or done any editing when I was at GMBN. I started, I guess, 2.5 years ago now, and just self-taught myself, watching YouTube tutorials, watching other people on YouTube, seeing what I liked of their style and how I could take that over into the mountain bike industry.
Awesome.
And tell stories.
Yeah. Do you know what attracted GoPro to you in the first place? Have they ever sort of explained why they approached you?
I've never asked the question.
Okay.
I got a DM on Instagram from the UK channel saying, we'd like to have a chat. Went on a call with them and I was like, that sounds awesome. And then it just kind of grew from there. And I've been lucky enough to go to like MotoGP and watch that Silverstone for the last 2 years and get tickets right to be right in the front, walk through the pit lane. Been to snow events with them, did a big piece with them this year for the Hero 8 launch. And yeah, they definitely gave me a lot of inspiration.
Yeah. So what kit were you using then when you started out doing your first vlogs? Was it, I mean, I'm guessing some GoPro kit. Were there other cameras as well that you were using?
Yeah. So I started out with, I think it was a Hero 6 when I started out doing the vlogs. It had just been launched. And I also had a Panasonic GH5. So they are my two cameras.
Yeah.
And the GH5 was like almost like a perfect learning camera. I actually still use it today for both photo and video, but it was like the perfect one. It wasn't insanely expensive compared to like a Sony or a Canon. It was kind of like a nice price point. It was small. It was really robust, which appealed to me with mountain biking. Semi water resistant as well, so you could go for a long ride, chuck it in the backpack, and didn't really have to be overly cautious. And a lot of people were already using it for filming and photo stuff, so it was like winner.
Yeah.
So that was my setup, and yeah.
Was it a steep learning curve then? Because I've had a little bit of a go with some video stuff, and it's I found it pretty hard work, to be fair.
It was I don't know if it was a steep learning curve, but it was more like every time that I used it, I would learn something. Or I'd think, I filmed it this way. Why did I not do it that way? And you'd go back and you'd watch it for yourself. And, you know, you might have had it in the wrong frame rate setting, or you might have had the shutter speed wrong. And sort of learning all that, the best way that I could have done it was just be thrown in at the deep end and start filming my own content.
And what was your first video that you put out there? Do you remember it?
First proper one that I did was like vlog of getting my new Scott Genius bike, where I actually went to Shimano, had a meeting out there, picked up some parts, and then flew home, built the bike up, and it just went really well. Like, people seemed to really like the bike build concept, and it kind of just developed from there. So I had like 2 minutes, I think, of talking being at Shimano, and then about a 5 minute video of actually building up the Genius, being it completely raw, and just the sound of the bike and the assembly of it.
Was it hard to build up an audience to kind of grow your following on the YouTube side of things?
I guess I was lucky from doing stuff at GMBN that I had people knew who I was already. So I had, I think, at that time, about 1,000 subscribers on YouTube. And I had maybe 20, I think it was about 29,000 on Instagram.
Okay.
And I put up the first video that I did, and it kind of just really grew from there. And I think overnight it had about 20,000 views, and I was like, whoa, this is insane. And within maybe the first week, I had about 15,000 subscribers already. And I was like, wow, this is really cool. I'm so stoked on this. And I'd kind of thought if I had like half of that within the first month, I'd be really happy. And it kind of just, the growth at the start really accelerated, and got quite excited, and then did some other videos like the first ride of the Genius. People really liked that again, did some POV. And then it just kind of grew from there. And the first trip I think I did on my own was with Schwalbe for the launch of the Hans Dampf, and did like an Israel vlog. People really liked that. People also liked the Israel content and following along. And at that time I was really, had a huge focus also on Instagram stories, and I was shooting everything on my GH5, putting it onto my phone, and then putting it onto Instagram, and they're a really high level, and I think I got a lot of engagement there, and that kind of grew my story too, and people wanted to follow along because it's quite personable and telling like a cool story through amazing imagery.
So you mentioned it was on the Scott stuff. Were you kind of working with them from pretty early on in the vlogging side of things, and how did that come about?
Yeah, so I'd always worked a little bit with them, had grown a relationship with them and approached them with my idea. The idea was like pretty vague and loose, and they sort of trusted in me and gave me some support that would allow me to do it. I got bikes and a little bit of financial compensation as well for the work that I sort of proposed to them. And when the first video came out, they also had a video of me riding the bike, and the two went really well together, and it got hit up instantly. So that relationship just kind of grew. So now it's been 2 years with those guys. Absolutely love the bikes. I've been involved with a couple of product launches, and we've just re-signed for another two as well.
What do you think brands are looking for these days then? Because there's a lot of people out there that kind of either want to get sponsored or they want to become an ambassador for a brand. What do brands look for? What kind of information do you provide them with when you're pitching?
So I basically just give them an offer of what I want to do across a year, how I think it can sort of improve their communications with my audience and also their audience, and educate as well, and sort of tell stories with photo and video content. But there are so many ways to do it now. Like, you could be an athlete for racing, you could be an athlete, or you could just be like a content creator and telling the story through imagery and videography. So I think it's really hard to say what a sponsor wants directly. You've got to have something a little bit unique. And then also with my mechanical engineering background, it's good because I can relay information in a way that people can understand without it being overcomplicated. And I have the presenting side from that I learned at GMBM that people can engage with and learn from. And this year I did the Shimano SLX and XT launch, did a first look with Shimano that was like quite highly produced and like a really, really nice piece. So there's a whole bag of things that you can offer aside from just having to be a racer now.
Yeah, definitely. And has it ever been like challenging financially, or has it always been relatively easy for you to make a living doing what you're doing now?
It's been pretty challenging. I mean, this is the first time that I've ever made a living from mountain biking that feels like it could be sustainable. But at the same time, I've been away a lot. I've put a lot of effort into it. And I think that's what makes me stand out, though, is that I do put a lot of effort in. I do trips. I try to keep the audience engaged. I've got like good numbers for growth. It's growing nicely. But yeah, it is a lot of work and nothing comes easy, but I wouldn't swap it for like an easier position or something like that, because I absolutely love it. I love traveling. I love getting to ride my bike in different places, and I love experiencing new cultures. So if you put the work in, you get the reward, right?
Yeah. Do you think being a talented bike rider is a necessary part of it? Like, obviously that's one of your kind of unique skills that you've pulled together, but how important do you think that is in the mix?
It's a pretty hard one to answer, because you've got a lot of YouTubers now who I'd say don't have a racing background or a professional athlete career, but they're doing well out of just being themselves and being personable. And like, you look at SAS Bike Hacks and BKXC, those guys have never raced or anything, but they have huge, huge followings just because they're telling a story in a creative way that's different to other people. And they're not the best riders, but they still have a good time, and people can get involved with that. They can also be inspired to go to these destinations and want to travel too, and realize that you don't have to be a professional rider to actually travel the world and ride your bike or go and ride these trails. You can just go and have fun and be as you are, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. And you've definitely been having fun. I've been watching some of your videos throughout the year. One of the series I wanted to pick up on was the track down stuff that you've been doing with GoPro, where you've had the chance to ride with some pretty awesome people. Tell us a little bit about that project and what it's been like to put together.
Yeah, so that was really cool. GoPro approached me on that. They had the idea that they wanted to go to 5 different destinations in Europe and tell the story of me meeting up with another athlete and going for a ride. So we went to Bike Park Wales with Brendan. We went to La Palma with Jeff Gulovich, Finale Liguri with Nikolai Rogatkin, Sweden with Brooke McDonald, and then Portugal, Sintra with Michaela Gatto. And it was just it's like a huge mix of athletes there. You've got Brendan, who's insanely skilled in downhill, but has done Red Bull Rampage. You've got Brooke, who's super fast. You've got Rogatkin, who's like the craziest, probably one of the craziest guys on a mountain bike when it comes to sort of dirt jump and freestyle. We put him on an enduro bike, and I guess to a degree, he was out of his comfort zone, but we had an absolute time. I've never been with someone who's like screaming the whole way down the trail, like, "That is so sick, I almost died here." And you can just tell that he's having a great time and I'm laughing, and it's like a really cool environment. And I think if you don't actually know Rogatkin, and you just watch him from being on slopestyle scene, you could maybe think that he was a little bit arrogant or driven just to win, but he actually just loves riding his bike. He has a great time like riding, and he has a great time going to the contest. And some of the stories he was telling about slope style and training and stuff, it was just cool getting a bit of a different insight to their lives. And the same with Brute, the same with Brandon. He spent probably 4 days doing each shoot, and you just get to know them a little bit and you share more and more. And then, you know, they're human too, and you just have cool interactions with them and share stories of riding or travel, or and you just relate to each other because you have one thing in common, and that's riding bikes.
Yeah, everyone's human at the end of the day, however successful they are, right?
Yeah, I think it is quite easy to forget that, though. And I think for those guys, they're put on a bit of a pedestal. But at the end of the day, they're just having fun and riding bikes. And it just so happens that they've really mastered it and done well for themselves at it. But they still love chatting about it and doing other things. And yeah, it was a cool insight, I guess. And then I've come away with having like really good friends from it, and really good friends with Gully and Michaela. And Gully and I have done other trips since then. So it's been awesome. It was like a really, really good thing to do.
Yeah. Do you ever feel nervous with riders like that following you down trails?
No, we had a good laugh about it. Brooke was maybe the most nerve-wracking, I'd say. He was the one out of all of them who was definitely on, he like wanted to ride really, really fast. And you can see that if you go back and watch that episode, you can actually see that Brooke and I are pushing pretty hard, and he's really right on my tail a lot of the time, and I could hear him, and that was like, it was a lot of fun because he was pushing me to go further, to go faster and do different things, and you start making little mistakes and he's like, come on mate, I'm right behind you, like come on, get off the brakes, those big 29 inch wheels. He was on a 27, and you know, there's just a little bit of banter back and forth, and yeah, it was good fun. But he was definitely the most nerve-wracking to ride with. And then Brandon was fun. I know Brandon a little bit from being a Scott athlete, and we've done a couple of things together. I actually stayed with him in Whistler last year at the Scott house for Crankworks. So we had a good time filming there, and it was just nice riding with him. And he has a bit of a laugh with me as well and pushes me, and we're right on each other's tails all the time. And then there is one gap, and I was like, dude, I'm just going to leave this one to you. And it looks massive in the video. It is pretty big, but I almost regret not having done it. I just wasn't feeling on my A game that day.
Fair play. It's always there for you when you go back.
Exactly, exactly. I actually just saw that they've been back up at Bike Park Wales, Brendan, and he's been doing some more gaps. So fair play to him.
Yeah, no messing in those guys.
So yeah, it's been a pretty cool journey to get to where I am. I've got to travel to some insane places, and as like a kid, I guess, growing up like 14, 15, 16, I could never have dreamed of what I'm doing now. Like this year, probably the craziest trip that I got to do was with H&I Adventures. They took us to Ecuador.
Wow.
And met with Thomas Vanderham there, and had about 10 days riding with Vanderham, filming, shooting. And it was just this insane experience, because the whole time growing up, I watched New World Disorder, like the likes of Seasons, Rome, all those Ant Hill films. And he's a huge part in that. And actually just getting to ride with him and finding out that he's a super humble, quiet guy who just likes to ride his bike was nice, you know. We had a really good time, experienced this complete new culture in Ecuador. And the most memorable thing of it is probably riding this volcano, the Cotopaxi volcano. And we got uplifted up to about, I think it was about 4,000 meters that you started from. And it was a 1,000 meter drop back to the pickup point. But you dropped in, and I've never ridden anything like it. It was this ash field, and you were just like pushing into the ground. It was almost like skiing powder, because you push in and it would go really light. You'd sink in and you pull out, push into the next turn. And there's actually a really cool photo of each of us. And you can just see the like line behind us. It's just like chopped into the ash. And then the next day it rained, and we went back and did it. And you wouldn't even know we'd been there the day before. It was just a complete blank canvas, and so cool. It was kind of my first ever free ride experience, I guess.
Yes, unique.
Yeah, and that was super cool.
So how do these trips like come together? How do you go about planning a trip like this and making sure that you're going to, you know, everything's going to fit together, you're going to be able to find all the best ride in?
So a lot of the ones I've done have been in partnership with people who have invited us to come. The one in Ecuador was with H&I, who are actually a Scottish company, and they offer tours all around the world. I actually went on a holiday with my mom and sister with them recently to Nepal, and there was like a 12-day guided trip. They had RJ Ripper, Mandal Parahan guiding us around the very best trails in Nepal. And then other ones like the GoPro series, we had local guides on the ground. So we used We Ride PT. We used one in Finale Liguri with a girl called Louise. The Sweden episode was just in the bike park, so that was easy enough to navigate. But a lot of them, there's always been someone on the ground who's either given me a personal invite or who's been organized through.
You did a big trip to Norway as well recently. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so the Norway one was, it was almost one of those unplanned, spontaneous ones that were just worked out. I went to university with a really good friend called Steve. Yeah, I call him Sender Steve McAlpine because he used to play ice hockey. And he was a guy at ice hockey who would start the fight. So he's really pretty built. He's a big, muscular guy. And he has a Canyon Sender. And he just absolutely goes for it. When I knew him at university, he didn't ride. So he's only started riding in probably the last 4 years. And since then, has gotten really into it. I've been over to see him a couple of times down south when he was working as an engineer for, I think it was Triumph at that time. And then he's come up here a couple of times. He's Scottish originally, but he's moved out to Norway to live with his fiancée. And he invited me over for a weekend. We're just going to do 2 days riding up in Hafja and a day in Drammen. Got there, I hadn't booked a return flight yet, and he was like, man, I'm thinking I might just take a few extra days off. So we went up to Hafja, rode there, had a great time. Sender Steve was on form, he was sending all the jumps right behind me, and we had a really, really good weekend there, and we just planned to drive further north. And we drove north. I actually can't remember all the names of these places because they're in Norwegian and they're pretty hard to say, but we drove north into the fjords. It was incredibly stunning. It was absolutely beautiful. We're driving through this town. We'd stayed somewhere overnight, woke up. It was raining. It was wet and miserable. So we drove a little bit further, sort of back towards Oslo, but via all the fjords. And we pulled into this one town, sitting having lunch and a coffee. And an old friend walks past and he's like, man, no way. What are you doing here? And I was like, wait, what are you doing here? And he was like, I live here. And I was like, no way. So he was like, you have to go and ride this ridgeline. Roughly pointed up at this ridgeline, 1,000 meters above sea level, looked absolutely stunning, really cool traverse down, showed us a couple of photos. And instantly we were like, right, we are doing this today. So went up there. It was about a 3-hour ride up. And the way we discovered it was with one of my partners called Kamut. Kamut is a mapping they basically can map routes for you. They can plan it. And one of the really cool things about it is the fact that it tells you how much is on gravel, how much is single track, if there's any tarmac sections. So you have a rough idea of the route. So put that into Kamut, went up this hill climb, got to what was like a really big overlook. The fjords were down below, stunning up there. And then it was like a really cool ridgeline ride down on the edge of a cliff, basically. Super loose, super scary, tiny little thin path, but just one of those rides that you'd never have found otherwise if you hadn't had sort of that key sort of someone saying to you, like, this is where you need to go, and then putting it in and actually finding it and mapping it. And then, so we did that one day, then the next day we went further south, and we went up to another one. And this one we'd just been told where the starting point was, but had no idea on anything else where the path was. Used Kamut again, mapped it in. We got as far as the path went. And the path actually continued this further that hadn't been mapped yet. And we went up into what was the glacier. The glacier was slowly retracting over the last few years. And it was just one of those like surreal experiences of being it completely unplanned. They're all coming together in the end and just riding one of the coolest trails and just having an amazing experience with with a mate. We were just there to have fun, basically. We weren't filming it. I had a GoPro and that was it. And we just rode down, shot some POV, shot a few photos. But it was just absolutely stunning. And Norway is one of those places where you turn every corner and you're like, God, I just really want to ride down that ridgeline or work out if there's a trail there. And it's just such amazing scenery.
It sounds pretty special. What, out of all of these places that you've ridden, when have you been most scared on a trail? Like, because a lot of these, you know, the most amazing rides tend to come with a bit of exposure.
Yeah, I think the ones that have been most scary is when you're out in the middle of nowhere and you don't really know where you are. You don't really know what would happen if you had an accident. And you just have to kind of go with it, forget about that element and just, you know, have fun with it. Because when you start thinking about what if an accident happens or what if this happens, then the tendency is that thing is going to happen. So you just kind of have to enjoy being there in the moment.
And do you take much kit with you on these kind of rides where you're right out in the middle of nowhere? What sort of stuff do you ride with?
I tend to keep it quite minimalistic, generally because I have a camera pack with me as well, with camera gear in it. But a lot of the big guided trips, the guide will always carry like a first aid kit. They might even have a radio or a sat phone.
Yeah.
So there's always a way of getting communication if you do get into some element of danger. But Norway was the first time that, you know, I'd really gone out there on my own. I didn't have a plan. We didn't really know what to expect either. So it was kind of a learning curve too of what we might need to take when we go to do something like that again. And without having Komoot, we wouldn't have had any idea where to go. So that was, you know, having that app was a good starting point.
Yeah.
And then from there on, I definitely think, you know, it'd be worth learning a bit more about medical kit that you should carry or basic medical procedures if you did have an accident.
Yeah, for sure. So out of all these places you've been, what's been your favorite, let's say, in the last 12 months? What stands out? You mentioned the Ecuador trip, but that, is that the number one?
I think it'd be between Ecuador and Nepal, both because they were completely different to what I've ever ridden in my life. Nepal was really, really cool. Like, I rode with RJ, went up to the Mustang and started a trail that was about 4,500 meters. And it was so fast. I'd never ridden it before. RJ had done it like numerous times guiding, so knew exactly where to go. And the trail was probably as thick as the laptop I'm sat in front of right now. And you were just trusting him. I was following him like super close to him. All I could basically see was a tiny bit of trail, his back tire, and just dust was kicking off. And I was just trying so hard to just stay with him. And that was probably one of the coolest experiences, I think. And then it would have to be the Ash story that I told you about already, riding with Vanderhaan.
Yeah. And you've obviously, like you say, been to all these cool places, but is there anywhere that you haven't ridden yet that you really want to go to? What's on your list of places to hit up?
I think Alaska's up there.
Okay.
Just because, again, it sounds so wild. There's not a huge population up there. You've also got wildlife that you have to deal with and are prepared for. And there's big mountains. I've seen some of Darren Bearclaw stuff, and that just looks really cool, man. And then, of course, South America. I've only done bits and pieces like Ecuador, and I did an EWS in Chile. So I'd like to go back and explore the likes of Peru or Colombia. So that's kind of like where I'd like to go next. And I mean, there's still bits of Europe as well to do, like further east that haven't really been ticked off or haven't really been talked about either. So there's still plenty to get out there and do.
Yeah. And what about people? Who do you want to ride with that you've not done anything with yet?
Who do I want to ride with I've not done anything with yet? That's a hard one. I've never really thought about that. I've thought about trips I'd like to do with people that I've already met, I'd say more. Mm-hmm. Like this year, Jeff Gulovich was one of them. He's just such a fun guy. Like, we just have a laugh together and it's just easy travel with him. And the same with, I went to Japan a couple of weeks ago with Casey Dean, who's also like a world-renowned skier, and we had a great time together. He was like really laid back and chilled, and those two dudes were definitely two of the people that I met this year that I was like, I'd love to go back somewhere else with them and do like a similar trip idea.
Okay. And is there anyone that you kind of look up to or admire or are inspired by that you haven't ridden with that you'd like to?
I'd maybe say someone like Petey would be a cool one to do something with. I've always looked up to Steve. I now do know Steve a little bit, but I've never actually been out for just like a casual ride or done anything with him like on an adventure basis. And I think that he'd be quite a cool person to go and do something with. But in terms of other people, like I've actually ridden with Nino Schroeder.
Nice.
And that was a really humbling experience. We went for an enduro ride around his home trails, and he's super fast at riding enduro, especially in his home trails. So he was pinned, and that was, again, one of those surreal experiences. My teammate, when I was on Cube, was like, okay, man, on the way back from finale, make sure you drop past and we'll go for a ride with Nino. He got ill or couldn't ride or maybe was injured. I can't quite remember. And he was like, don't worry, I've organized it all with Nino. So you just have to turn up at his house. This is his address. He's going to take you for the local loop. And I was like, really? And it was like crazy, you know, like Nino is someone that I think is still on a pedestal. He's like one of the best athletes in the world when it comes to cross country. And he probably is one of the best athletes in the world generally. And getting to ride with him on his home trails was just really, really fun, and seeing a different side of him away from the racing, and really had a good time doing that with him. So I'd love to go and do something again with him. And, you know, it's probably not impossible, especially with the relationship we both have with Scott.
Yeah, man, that'd be an interesting project. That guy's a beast on a bike in many ways. So like you say, you've had the chance to ride with a lot of amazing people over the years. Maybe give us a few things that you've picked up from these people, things that you've learned or things that you've taken away in many ways, I guess. So there's the kind of performance on a bike, technique, there's the promotional element, I guess, and how these people put themselves out there, but also, you know, just being good humans as well. What sort of things have you picked up along the way that you've put into your own life?
I think one of the big things I've picked up from probably Brendan is how approachable he is with people. Like, you see him when we're at Bike Park Wales and kids would be coming up and he'd take a moment just to spend time with them, chat to them, talk about their bike, see what they're riding, hear about their day. And I think that's really cool. It's a great way to realize that everyone is just human. Whenever anyone comes and tries and approach me, I try to have that same thing that I saw Brendan have with the kids and inspire them, let them talk about their day, make them get excited about riding. And, you know, a lot of people also have some sort of a shared common interest, whether it's a bike they're riding or the kit or where you are. And it's just really, it's always nice sharing that experience because we're all out doing what we love and it's just riding bikes. And there shouldn't really be any separation from whether you're like a beginner, whether you're intermediate or whether you're a pro racer.
Yeah, it's nice. It is cool when you see riders taking time. Danny McCaskill's someone that's really good at that. I've seen him spend like hours just trying to move a few meters at Fort William World Cup, but he will never not stop and chat to people, which is super cool.
Yeah, Danny's really good for that as well. And the same with Fabio Wibner. You see him a lot and he's got like a incredible worldwide audience now, but he's really, really good with all the kids. And you see him stopping and chatting, and he's at an event where he's actually trying to do something and he can't move for going through those guys. So he's also a person that I guess I look up to. I've done stuff in the past with Fabio and Elias, but I'd love to do some more stuff with those guys too, because I think especially Fabio, he's really pushing the boundaries of what you can do on a bike and what you can do filming creatively.
Definitely. So yeah, what do you think people want to watch these days? Like we keep getting told that people's attention's getting shorter and shorter, but there definitely is a lot more content to choose from. What do you think people want to see? What's popular?
I think it's kind of like a bit of a mixed bag, isn't it? Because some people love watching the longer form episodes of people going somewhere and discovering a culture. And then I think what's harder now is just having a like banger edit of it being like 3 minutes of just riding. I think it's really got to have a story and feature more of the individual who's riding. and sort of share that experience of what they're doing, where they are, and try and get a feel so you're involved in the video as well. And I think that's probably the hardest thing to do at the moment. There's sort of really a few people who are managing to do that. Fabio is kind of one of those really unique ones, I think, who still has that element that you could watch. Like, I think he just released this week, it was his latest video, and it's like an 8-minute video. There's no talking in it, but it's just insane riding. And I think there's only a few riders left who can create that insane riding video without it being sort of a story of travel or a story about themselves that people can get really involved in and get a feel for. So I think it's a mix between those like classic shred edits probably need to be really short and snappy now. And then there's kind of the longer form episodes that people like to watch and actually feel as if they know the person and follow along the journey.
Yeah. And have you found it harder personally to kind of get people's attention or to stand out? Or do you think you've got an established audience now and they know what to expect from you?
I wouldn't want to say that I found it easy. Definitely not. And don't want to get too comfortable either. So it's kind of always progressing what you're doing. You don't want to get complacent. You want to keep moving, keep things fresh, keep mixing things up, do things a little bit differently. But yeah, I think it's pretty hard now to stand out because there are a lot of people trying to do it. You see more and more athletes are getting into video creation and content creation and trying to tell the story. And then there's also the side of more and more people trying to get onto YouTube and build their YouTube accounts. Like you look at Remy Metallier, he's someone who's done Rampage and now he's really trying to work on YouTube and build that up and doing more and more on it.
Have you progressed your kind of the technical side of your edits and your videos? You mentioned you're still using the Panasonic today, but have you kind of changed your kit along the way and up the, I guess, the production levels?
Definitely up the production levels and been involved with having filmmakers and photographers more rather than self-shooting it, which has made a huge difference. And that's something that I couldn't do without the support of sponsors because it just isn't financially viable to do that on your own. So in that element, I've sort of enhanced it. I've also learned more skills. I've thought about transitions. I've thought about how you can change stuff. I've worked on color, worked a little bit more on sound. And it's still a constant learning thing. I'm by no means anywhere where I want to be yet, but I've also been really focused on producing a lot of content in quite a short space of time. And sort of the next stage that I want to go to is doing less content, but higher quality with better storytelling, being in places for longer rather than going somewhere for like 2-3 days. Actually spending like 10 days there, getting a feel more for that location, getting more into the locals, learning about the culture, and telling the story of riding different trails in those areas. So that's kind of what I want to do next. And it's like a development of what I've been doing.
So do you think it gets to the point where you'll almost outsource the filming element of it? You'll pay professionals to come in and do that side of things? Or will you always want to do that kind of yourself?
I think a bit of both. Like I enjoy the filming myself, but there's only so much that you can do to get something really unique and cool. So I still want to be the rider because that's what I love doing. I love going places to ride. So the next thing will be getting someone to help film it. I also really enjoy the editing side and I feel there's still so much to learn about. And that is one of the things I've loved getting to this point is learning new things, learning new traits. And that's also been one of the great things about working with GoPro is the fact that I have met people on every trip that I've gone on, I've learned something from someone that I didn't think of before. And just sort of continuously challenging yourself, I guess, is what I want to keep doing, whether it be wilder locations, planning different locations, how you can make logistics happen, to shooting it, to then editing it and creating something really cool and quite unique.
Yeah. Where do you look to for your inspiration then as you're kind of looking to progress and move forward? Where do you look? Who inspires you? Is it inside mountain biking or is it coming from elsewhere?
There's a few people inside mountain biking that I look up to, the likes of like Danny McCaskill, Fabio Wibner, what those guys do, working with MTB Cut. And then Fabio's now got his own production company, which is pretty cool. And he's got a team of about 3 or 4, it looks like, who are, I don't know if they're full-time, part-time, whatever, but they all work for him and produce the content kind of with him too. So that's pretty cool. That's like a big way of looking up to it. And then outside of mountain biking, it's the likes of like Ben Brown, Jon Olsen, and then going on to like brands like Douchebags and what they've created with their sort of branding and their imagery and their storytelling.
Yeah, cool. All right. Well, we're getting close to the end of our time, so we'll wrap up with our standard final questions. The first one of those is, if our listeners had £150 to spend to improve their performance on a bike, what would you recommend they spend it on?
£150. I would probably say new tires. Tires for the conditions and the elements that they're riding in. That would probably be a good one. And with that £150, you could probably get tires and a full tubeless setup if they weren't already tubeless.
Yeah.
I think that's probably the biggest performance enhancement that you can make to a bike.
And what's your go-to in a Scottish winter?
Go-to in a Scottish winter is probably Schwalbe Magic Marys, both front and rear. And if it's really muddy, then might put a Dirty Dan on the front.
Yeah. And do you use like super gravity casing or?
Yeah, always super gravity. Pretty much on all the bikes, even on my Spark, which is a 120 bike, I have super gravity on the rear and then the lighter casing on the front, just because, you know, I don't really want to go anywhere and get a flat tire. And that's definitely been the most reliable setup that I've ever had. I hate carrying a tube. I don't really like wearing a backpack. I wear a backpack enough for when I'm filming.
Yeah.
So if I can get away with not having to take anything, then I will do it.
Makes sense. All right. Question two. If you could wind back the clock and sit down with yourself age 16, what advice would you give him?
What advice would you give him? That's a hard one. Maybe train a little bit harder and go a little bit faster for World Cups. I think that would be... But then it'd be an interesting journey, because if you went back and changed that, would I be doing what I'm doing now, or would it be a completely different career path? So,
yeah, do you miss the racing side of things? Like, do you regret like not maybe putting more into that and trying to make it work?
There are definitely times when I'll watch a downhill World Cup and I'll see the likes of like Danny doing so well now, and like I was never really far off him as a youth and junior. But, you know, like you can't go back and change these things. And I love watching those guys doing well now, and like the battle this season with like Loic, Omri, Danny, Laurie, like seeing those guys do well is so cool. And I think the way that downhill's developed for getting people into this sport and inspiring people to get into mountain biking is absolutely awesome.
Yeah, definitely. Good stuff. All right, question three then. And again, you've been lucky to ride with a lot of awesome people, but if you could have a coaching session with anyone past or present, who would it be and what would you want to learn from them?
I think I'd go with Vanderham, and I'd want Vanderham to show me how to do those really insane flat moto whips that he does.
Sweet. How is your whip game? Is it strong or not?
It's pretty good, but I wouldn't say it's anywhere near Vanderham or Brandon Fairclough level.
Yeah. Yeah, those guys especially.
I mean, now I even think about like Cade Edwards and Chaos. Those guys are just ridiculous.
Yeah, next level. Super impressive. All right, and then the final question. What's something that you do every day that you feel benefits you?
Probably make a coffee.
Are you a big coffee fan?
Huge coffee fan. Absolutely love it. Got into when I was working at GMBN, there was a really good coffee shop, and that just like changed the game for me. And then this year I actually treated myself and bought a Rocket espresso machine.
Oh, nice.
And absolutely love it. It's like my favorite thing. I was away in New Zealand for this past month, and the one thing that I was really excited to come back and do was just make my own coffee. Like you can have as many coffees out as you want, but there's some satisfaction of like weighing the coffee, grinding it, weighing it again, making sure that it's like coming through at the right time. Yeah, just love it. Love the whole procedure.
Yeah, it's like it's a good geeky engineer kind of process driven thing, and it's fun.
Yeah, you feel like quite scientific almost.
Yeah, yeah. So how do you drink your coffee? Espresso kind of guy or?
Generally flat white.
Okay, yeah.
Sometimes I'll do a filter coffee or an AeroPress.
Uh-huh.
But generally flat white. I was going to say, I was away in New Zealand and we went into this coffee shop, and they did a flat white flight. So you got three different flat whites, all with different beans. And it was just a cool experience to taste every different one. and I didn't sleep that night at all. Absolutely wired.
Awesome. And how's your latte art?
Latte art is, I'd say low. I'd be a 5 out of 10. It could be a good day, it could be a bad day.
Okay.
I've got the espresso pretty dialed now, okay. I think, in a way.
Nice. Work in progress then.
Yeah, definitely.
Cool. Well, if people want to find out more and follow what you're up to, where's the best place for them to look?
Yeah, so Instagram is just easy. It's at Scotty Lachlan. And then YouTube for the longer videos is youtube.com/Scotty Lachlan.
Good stuff. We'll put links in the show notes so people can find all of that.
Yeah.
Wicked. Nice one. Well, it's been super interesting chatting. And yeah, look forward to following your adventures and seeing where you end up in 2020.
Yeah, likewise. Look forward to listening to some more podcasts and hope that everyone who has listened to this has enjoyed it and had a little insight into the journey of getting to where I am now and also some racing stuff.
Cool. Nice one. Cheers, Scotty.
Cheers, dude.
All right, that's it for this episode with Scotty. I hope you've enjoyed listening. A massive thanks to Komoot for supporting this episode of the podcast. Komoot are offering all our listeners a free regional map bundle of your choice worth $8.99. All you need to do is to head to komoot.com/G. That's Komoot spelled K-O-M-O-O-T. And use the code DOWNTIME2020, all one word, all uppercase. And that offer is valid for all new Komoot users until the end of April 2020. So head over to komoot.com and give it a try for free. If you've got a couple of minutes, then leave us a review wherever it is that you listen to the show. Give us a follow on social media where we're at Downtime Podcast. Subscribe to the show so you get all of our episodes delivered straight to your device. And if you want to help support the podcast, then share the love at downtimepodcast.com/shop. Also, please spread the word, tell your friends about the podcast and share our episodes on social media. All right, we've got another episode coming up soon. But until then, get out and ride.